Welcome to the Perkins Platform. This is a solutions-oriented podcast and live radio show. Each broadcast would dedicate just about 30 minutes to explore topics of interest for leaders and professionals in education and a variety of other disciplines. And this is your host, Brian Perkins. Hello, everyone. Welcome. So excited today because I have someone who is going to join me in a conversation that I've had with countless people, particularly over the last 4 or 5 years, I'd have to say, and just as recent as today, talking about what seems to be happening and pervasive in our society about how bad is now good all of a sudden. And so I have someone who is an award-winning journalist and author, who was previously the editor-in-chief of Philadelphia Magazine, and just a variety of accolades to his credit. I'm pleased to welcome Tom McGrath. Welcome, Tom.
Thank you. It's a real pleasure to be here and to be able to talk to you.
Yes. So I know you have a book that a recent book, and you've been writing for quite a while. And actually a guest writer and journalist in several national publications. But tell me a little bit about really what got you interested in writing about politics and other things in culture and economy.
You know, I think it comes from the fact that I'm just sort of interested in what's going on in the world. And I'm sure that's the reason that I became a journalist. And it's sort of permission to go out and ask questions and dig stuff up and just sort of spend your time thinking about all these things. So I've had a terrific career and written about a lot of different things. I'm writing a lot about politics these days because politics is so weird and interesting and I think really consequential at this point. So a lot of what I've done lately has been focused on that. As you mentioned, I have a book that's about to come out in early June. It's called Triumph of the Yuppies. And it's broadly, it's about the 1980s, but more specifically, it's about the birth and rise of yuppies, young urban professionals. And the reason I'm interested in that is because I think that period helps explain where we are today in America. So many of the things that took place back in that period, I think we're still dealing with in a lot of ways. And that's partly lifestyle stuff, but it's also partly politics and partly things like income inequality.
Yeah.
All really start in that era. So
awesome. Fascinating. So I read a opinion piece that you wrote that, and I found it very fascinating on how bad became the new good. And I think for me, personally, I started to notice for the first time, I'm sure for you as someone who has been interested in this, maybe much earlier, but I remember probably if I had to say around 2007, 2006, 2007, there was this criticism, if you will, suddenly about individuals who had gone to top universities. And somehow, especially with then candidate Obama rising on the scene, there seemed to be a criticism of, oh, well, he was top of his class at Harvard. I mean, how relatable can he be? He was a constitutional law professor. How does that qualify him to be president? And I remember thinking, this is really strange that is something that would get people disqualified from arguably one of the most important positions in the world, that it said, hey, it's a smart person. B, they know a little bit about what they're being asked to govern and protect. And then I remember I had a small experience with it myself. I was engaged in some work in an American city, and there was some criticism about me being selected as the person to lead an effort. And so someone threw what seemed like to be a shady curveball to say, well, I mean, I guess having attended Yale doesn't hurt. And I just remember going, but is that supposed to be a criticism that, you know, somehow this person attending top university means that it's a bad thing. So I don't know what it was about, but certainly you wrote a bit about kind of these villains that exist, if you will. So I'd love to hear more about what in your study of it. Tell me a little bit about how it started, what got you interested in it, but then where you ended up with qualifying the people as, I think you said anti-heroes, I think may have been
right.
One of the terms you used.
Right. Well, I think you're right. I think this has been going on for a while. And I think, you know, you're going back 15 years or so. That sounds about right to me. And I think, you know, in part, this is about a distrust or a cynicism that's crept into our society. People maybe have felt alienated. And so if it's the people with those great credentials that have been running things, then, well, maybe they're the problem, right? At least that's the mindset
sure.
on this. Sure. But I also think, just to talk more about politics here, that our politics has gone hard in this direction really in the last 10 years, maybe the last half dozen years. And the particular piece that you referenced that I wrote several weeks ago about this idea, you know, the age of the antihero, really was prompted by there was a debate that maybe you or some of your listeners saw featuring Republican Congresswoman Lauren Boebert out in Colorado. And I just saw a friend actually called me and said, have you seen a clip from this debate? And he sent it to me. And what it was that there's, I think, 9 candidates on the stage. And for some reason, the moderator asks whether any of them have been arrested. Now, it's an odd question for a debate, but I'm like, okay. And Lauren Boebert raises her hand because she'd been arrested for something. And then another candidate raises his hand. And before you know it, five or six of them have raised their hands to say that they've been arrested. But rather than the audience being kind of aghast at this, the audience first starts to laugh, and then the audience starts to cheer as if this makes them somehow more qualified now to become a member of Congress. And I'm looking at this going, like, what has gone on in the world that now this is where we are?
Yeah.
And so it sort of got me thinking a little bit more deeply about, like, what's behind this? And I do think there is something to do with the difference between, and if you want to go back to literary terms here, there's the classic hero who's perceived as all good, and the classic villain who's perceived as all bad. But then there's the thing in between, which is the anti-hero, who is deeply flawed, but somehow we still kind of root for them anyway. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, there's plenty of people, particularly in politics, that sort of fit in that basket right now.
Mm-hmm. Would you describe it in terms of, like, we think back to some of our earliest stories, like Robin Hood, someone sure. that's perceived that, you know, it's not good to steal. However, you're doing bad for a purpose. Is it? But there still seems to be some confusion around that as well, because even some of these things are don't quite hold up to the Robin Hood analogy.
I think Robin Hood is a great example. And I think before we even go deeper on this, I think partly this is about perception, that you and I could look at the same character and mm-hmm. you perceive them as a villain and I perceive them as an antihero, right? Mm-hmm. So we don't always see the same thing. Sure. But Robin Hood is a good example. And I think, you know, as I did some research on antiheroes, as I wrote this piece, you know, there are two qualities about antiheroes. One is that they're not a traditional hero, that a traditional hero has courage and all those sort of virtues. They don't have that. But you're right that there is a sense that they are somehow fighting for a higher good, even though they might be not following the traditional rules.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they're appealing to people. So Robin Hood is an appealing character, in part because, A, there's part of us that kind of likes rule breaking, right? Like, sometimes it's a pain to follow all the rules.
Sure.
So we sort of viscerally, or, you know, like, you know, can sort of latch onto, oh, that's cool that he doesn't have to follow the rules. But then if they couple with that, with the idea that they're fighting for a higher good beyond these sort of social niceties, that they're fighting for something higher.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the political candidates that have sort of capitalized on this in terms of being perceived as antiheroes have done that. And, you know, I don't want to make this too much about Donald Trump, but he's kind of the one I refer to in this piece of having done that. So Donald Trump breaks all kinds of rules. I mean, literally breaks laws, or he's been accused of breaking laws.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, for some reason, that only seems to make him more attractive to many of his supporters. And I think it's because A, they kind of like the fact that, oh, he breaks the rules. Isn't that cool that we get to do that? Or some part of us likes that. But it seems to prove his point that he's fighting back against this bigger American establishment that has screwed them. And he's the only one that's really fighting for them. And so I think that's partly how the narrative plays out to some of his supporters. That's why they see him as, quote, an anti-hero.
Sure, sure. So have you studied at all or in your research on the piece uncovered what the psychology is? Because I've been thinking about this really more deeply over the past few years, just trying to understand. Because I've heard on news and on the news and various panels toss around words like cult personalities, not just one person but multiple people playing from that playbook of I'm here to help you, to save you, to lead you to the promised land, but that these strategies, if you will, from some playbook or how others have received power, and particularly political power, has been really difficult for us to get our heads around because it's really playing into a deeper psychological narrative that human beings are kind of subjected to or susceptible to.
Right. Yeah, look, I'm sure I know there are people out there that have studied cults and cult leaders and can probably give you a much more sophisticated explanation of this. Mine is a little bit more of an armchair one. Mm-hmm. But here's where I think I've landed on this is that it goes back to sort of the lack of trust and the cynicism that I think I mentioned earlier, in the sense of I think we all tend to feel that people who look like they're good are maybe too good to be true. And we have somehow felt burned, you know, by whether it's government that has let us down or corporations that have let us down or people have let us down. Mm-hmm. And part of the appeal of the person who acts bad, of the anti-hero, is like, well, they're showing us their flaws right out in front. So that's, in a weird way, honest, right? Like, you're not hiding any from me. You really do bad things. You got arrested. You're not hiding anything. So maybe I can trust you because you're willing to share with me how bad you are. So that makes you good.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But there's a double
negative equals good, right?
Right. I mean, but there's a deep level of cynicism about that because it suggests that anyone who actually appears to be good couldn't possibly be good, which I think there are actually good people in the world, or mostly good people, right? So it's discouraging when you think about it on those terms, but yeah. I think that's where we are.
Yeah, yeah. And so I am the director of a program that prepares leaders specifically in schools, but more broadly the work that I've done with leaders across a variety of disciplines, and so we hear often people being told, okay, leave politics out of the workplace. But politics are so part of our daily lives, maybe as much as they've ever been, but they're so much a part of our daily lives. It's hard to leave that out of just where you are. Almost every conversation that has anything to do with the outside world is going to bring us back to politics. But even when people say, leave it out, we try. But my question is really about, so the implications for people who are in leadership roles having to manage, if we were to say it's a part of a broader psychology or pathology that we are experiencing, how do leaders who are trying to manage organizations of people lead traditionally for like good purposes or for specific purposes, understanding that now bad is good or like, so do we then, if we're bankers, do we then encourage people to shortchange the bank? right? Or, you know, because I've had to say to to either whether it's students or people in my own organization is that sometimes a small skip on a rule doesn't affect the whole organization. But if everyone takes that skip, it costs a lot more than just an individual. And so if we're all taking, you know, kind of stealing time, whether it's 15 minutes or a half hour, you multiply that times thousands of people in an organization in a day, a couple hundred hours of time that is gone, vanished. So, so my first question is, what do you think happens or is happening to in organizations that if, because it has to play a kind of have an effect on the day-to-day lives of people that are trying to encourage those people on the outside who are now inside of an organization?
Yeah, I think it's a really interesting and difficult question, because I think leading an organization these days is harder than it's ever been, or at least in my memory. Mm-hmm. And for all the reasons that you're saying, I mean, politics creeps into everything. It goes back to this sort of lack of trust thing that we talked about a moment ago. I think we're just in a moment, and I think you used the word pathology a minute ago. I think that's kind of where we are. We're living sort of with this pathology, and I think that puts a burden on individual leaders that I don't have an easy solution to how you do that. I think part of it has to come back to the idea of rebuilding trust, whether it's with the employees in an organization or customers that might be part of a business. And that's way easier said than done. But I think so many of those layers of trust have broken down. I'll just share a really quick story that I think maybe is relevant. So this piece that I wrote about Donald Trump and anti-heroes, I sent it out to, you know, I have a couple thousand subscribers to my newsletter, one of whom was a woman that I worked with on a nonprofit board who got it. And she turns out is a very big Trump supporter. And I got an email from her about a week ago saying, it's taken me a while to send this to you, but I completely disagree with everything you say. Mm-hmm. And only because we're friends that I'm not really going to rip into you. But then she extended an invitation. She said she has this discussion group that gets together once every couple of weeks. Would I be willing to come? She said, we're mostly Republicans, but we would love to hear a Democratic voice. I said, sure, this sounds great. And so I went this morning, and it was a fascinating conversation, because it started out a very tense kind of angry conversation. They're accusing Democrats of things, and I'm trying to defend Democrats. And it gets, but yeah, somehow in this conversation, we kind of got past the personalities of Donald Trump and Joe Biden, and just sort of, I think, started to talk to each other more as a country that has these problems. What's the right way to approach them? And when we did it that way, I think a lot of our agendas went aside, because we were just trying to focus on how would you solve a problem like immigration or AI or whatever the problem was. And yes, I think there was a little bit more trust in the room. So to go back to your question, I don't know how leaders of organizations necessarily do that, but I think that's some part of the answer to it.
Sure, sure. As often, communication, open communication is often a good place to start. I wonder how much of this is, at this point in time, a largely an American phenomena. I was just having a conversation with a colleague of mine who is in Italy, and he's doing some work. He's the CEO of an organization that does social emotional training in corporations, and really having people understand the other aspect, kind of the psychological, social wellness of the people that work there. And so we were talking about just how in the United States, people don't seem to want to engage in social, not social events, but things that bring them to a place, like attending conferences, attending workshops. Everybody wants to be virtual. And we both agreed that, having traveled, so now since COVID, I've been to four different continents, and it feels very different in other places. So people are out In all throughout Asia, they are having dinner and going for walks, and you see just wholesale people everywhere. And I'm just in amazement because I look around and then I think about back even near my campus at Columbia, things are dead most weekend. You know, people are not out, even in New York City. And so I'm just wondering, because there are aspects of what you've been talking about that are, that have been in other countries where politicians have had criminal records or been accused of some very negative things, but they seem to go on. But for me, and maybe it's because we're in the middle of it, for me, it seems like we are in a very different place. And in this tension between groups of people in our country that doesn't seem to be as widespread or has infected the real bloodline, if you will, of what it means to be an American, is two different things, it feels like at times.
I don't
sense that in other places. And so I was just wondering, have you taken a look at that? Have you thought about that or seen it in other places?
You know, I really haven't. So what you're saying is really interesting to me, because when you first started to raise the point, the thing that popped into my head was that, you know, social media, I think, is partly at the root of maybe where we are, that there's something about social media that brings out some of these negative tendencies in us. But of course, social media is everywhere. So that wouldn't be the explanation of why we're like this, whereas people in Italy or the UK or wherever are approaching things differently. Mm. I'd also say, by the way, I sometimes scratch my head at the current American instinct to stay in my home, because it's fine that you and I get to talk to each other virtually, but I would much rather sit in a room with you, as I would with most people that I talk to. I mean, I work out of my house right now, and I don't really like it. I would much rather go sit in an office where I can have colleagues and you know, people that I chat with just as I'm getting a cup of coffee. So I miss the way things used to be, but I'm clear, I'm in the minority in this country, because yeah. I go outside too and there's nobody around. Where'd they all go?
So
it's such an interesting phenomenon, and I would love to see, maybe somebody will do some research about why Americans are this way and people in some other places are not. It's really fascinating.
So back to thinking about this anti-hero, as you've described them, what do you see as, is there a way out of that? Because again, I just think about it in psychological terms, that it has to be something deeply psychological that is going on that has made us, if it's a pendulum, what was the time? Did we have a time when it was all good and we were striving to be good, great, perfect almost, and then there's almost a revolt against that? But I think also about what you said at the very beginning, is that maybe it is that because there was a profile that, you know, people who were maybe smart or maybe had taken a certain kind of straight path through life are seen as the problem because we're not perfect as a nation. And so they're the problem. You don't have people with real experiences. And so just the fact that you've been arrested or people admitting that they've done drugs, and somehow if you haven't done that, you can't possibly identify with me. Is there a way out? Have you thought about what it would take to turn that around?
You know, there's part of me that keeps waiting for the politician, and not to make this all about politics, but I think that's what I'm waiting for.
Yeah.
I think, is the politician who can, in an authentic way that connects, appeal to our better angels as opposed to our less worthy ones, because it seems like so much of politics these days, and I think this is on both sides, wants to go down, and it hits us in our sort of more guttural places. And you know, that's been true of politics for a long time, and has probably been true of politics forever, but occasionally there come along politicians who want to try and lift us up a little bit, and I think we need one of those. And I don't know what that person will look like or what exactly the message will be, because the minute someone tries to do it, I think our cynicism can kick in and say, well, you got to be a phony. But maybe there is someone out there who has those certain political gifts or skills that can somehow get past it and say, like, no, we're better than this. Yeah. We can treat each other more civilly. We can trust each other a little bit more. Mm-hmm. And if we do that, things will get better. And I keep looking for that person. I don't think we see him or her at the moment, but sure. Maybe they're just around the corner and sure. We're not far away from this.
Sure. So. I can't help but also think about some other conversations that I've had about accountability in our society, where once upon a time, if a politician said they were going to do something and didn't do it, it was almost a kiss of death. It was, you know, we're not voting for you again because you said you were going to do this and you didn't do it. Now that seems to be out the window, to the point where people can make very passionate statements and stands on a topic, and then in a matter of weeks or months, just say the opposite. And the people who were supporting it will go along with it. And yeah. And so the cat out of the kind of proverbial cat out of the bag, as I've often described it, was people discovering that you can say whatever you want to say and there's no accountability for it.
I was gonna ask,
is that part of the same dilemma there? That it's okay to lie. It's okay to not have an integrity around things that you've said.
No, I think these are part of the same thing. And partly it goes back to the, well, hey, you lied. I lie sometimes too. We're the same, you know, but I also think in political terms, it ends up being a lot of times all these people are promising is that I'm going to defend you against the real enemy, which is the person in the other party. And this goes across both parties. All I need to be is not that guy. And, you know, as long as I'm not that guy, then you're still on my side. And I can kind of do anything as long as I'm not him or her, right? So the bar is pretty low in terms of the promise. You know, just I'm not Joe Biden or I'm not Donald Trump. That's all I really promise to you. And, mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. So. Sure.
So tell me, so you got this new book coming out, Triumph of the Yuppies, America, the 80s, and the Creation of an Unequal Nation. So it's coming out in June. Give me a sneak preview on what you're talking about there.
Yeah. So it's really a history of yuppies, of young urban professionals. And for your listeners who were either too young to remember that or who have forgotten it because it was 40 years ago, mm-hmm. Yuppies really were this phenomenon in the 1980s, really kind of peaking in the mid 1980s. And yuppies were technically young urban professionals, but they sort of brought to the table this whole set of traits that they were very interested in money and career success. They were very materialistic. They were into fine food and fine wine and all those sorts of things. And they really sort of dominated the culture for a period of time until there was this big backlash against yuppies. And you got phrases like die yuppie scum and so mm-hmm. forth. There's kind of this backlash. So the book goes back and tells the story of where yuppies came from and how sort of this phenomenon came to be. But I also try and look at how the country changed so much in this period. And I kind of make the case that a lot of the values that yuppies embraced are values that we still hold on to today. So I mentioned income inequality before. Yuppies were very much about, I'm going to get my piece of the pie and I don't care what you get.
Yeah.
And I think we still live in that culture today in terms of corporate America. It's all about just making sure shareholders get their returns. And if that means laying off tens of thousands of people, then that's what we do. And we deem that acceptable. And I think a lot of the issues that we're dealing with right now go back to that period because the culture shifted so much in a way that I use yuppies to sort of tell that story of how things changed.
Interesting. Yeah, very fascinating. I almost forgot it as a word. I do remember that was something that was very common. And just thinking about some of the values that you mentioned about things of the fine wine and cars and luxury vacations and boats and all those kinds of things were symptomatic of what it meant to be successful.
Right, right. And I should say too that, that you know part of this book is meant to be enjoyable because the 80s were kind of over the top decade and there's lots of money being thrown around and there's big hair and big suits and big deals being done. And so I get into all of that. And, you know, I'm hoping that this book is entertaining to read in addition to hopefully making a deeper point about some of the cultural issues that have arisen out of that, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Well, I encourage leaders, first of all, to be students of history. That I think it's very important to know because of kind of generationally where if you are a leader in an organization, you have people from a span of backgrounds and histories, but also have been influenced by it. So individuals that are coming into the workforce now could likely have grandparents or parents that were a part of that. And so they've been influenced by that. So it's important for them to know that as well. So listen, this has been great. I'm so glad that you were able to come on. I'm sure there are people out there that want to know how they can learn about you, where they can get your book. But I know you have a newsletter. Share a little bit about your newsletter and tell people how they can reach you, social media handles, email addresses, websites, anything that they can do to support and follow your work.
Yeah, thanks for that opportunity. So I write a biweekly newsletter called Common Good. And if you're interested in that, you can go to tmcgrath.substack.com or you can just Google Tom McGrath and Substack, and I'm sure that will come up. And if you want to follow me on Twitter or X, I'm at T McGrath Philly, short for Philadelphia, T McGrath Philly on Twitter. And the book, Triumph of the Uppies, it'll be out in June, but it's available for pre-order now at Amazon, Barnes & Noble, your local independent bookstores. So if you're interested in that, those are the places you can get it.
Absolutely. Well, again, thanks so much. You've really added to me today. I'm sure people listening in feel the same. And so until I see your book and we get a chance to meet, go well, stay well.
Thanks very much. I really enjoyed the conversation.
Thank you.